This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Tower of Swallows, written by Andrei Sapkowski, translated by David French, read by Peter Kenny.
To Dundera they came at dead of night, for to seek the Witcher Maid. They ringed the hamlet from all sides and sealed it with a barricade. Caesar they would in perfidy, but their plans were all in vain. Ere the sun arose on the frozen road, 3 dozen brigands lay slain. A beggar's song about the frightful massacre which took place in Dundera on Samhain Eve. "I can give you everything you desire," said the fortune teller. "Riches, power and influence, fame and a long and happy life. Choose." "I wish for neither riches nor fame, neither power nor influence," rejoined the witcher girl. "I wish for a horse, as black and swift as a nightly gale. I wish for a sword, as bright and keen as a moonbeam. I wish to overstride the world on my black horse through the black night. I wish to smite the forces of evil and darkness with my luminous blade. This I would have." "I shall give you a horse, blacker than the night and fleeter than a nightly gale," vowed the fortune teller. "I shall give you a sword, brighter and keener than a moonbeam. But you demand much, witcher girl. Thus you must pay me dearly."
"With what? For I have nothing."
"With your blood." Florence Delanoy, Fairy Tales and Stories. Chapter 1. As is generally known, the universe, like life, describes a wheel. A wheel on whose rim 8 magical points are etched, making a complete turn the annual cycle. These points, lying on the rim in pairs directly opposite each other, include Imoloch, or budding, Lunasa, or mellowing, Beltana, or blooming, and Samhain, or dying. Also marked on the wheel are the 2 solstices, the winter one called Midinvierne and Midete for the summer. There are also the 2 equinoxes, Birke in spring and Velen in autumn. These dates divide the circle into 8 parts, and so in the elven calendar the year is also divided up like that. When they landed on the beaches in the vicinity of the Yeruga and the Pontar, people brought with them their own calendar, based on the moon, which divided the year into 12 months, giving the farmers annual working cycle, from the beginning with the markers in January, until the end, when the frost turns the sod into a hard lump. But although people divided up the year and reckoned dates differently, they accepted the elven wheel and the 8 points around its rim. Adopted from the elven calendar, Imoloch and Lunasa, Samhain and Beltana, both solstices and both equinoxes became important holidays, sacred tides for human folk. They stood out from the other dates as a lone tree stands out in a meadow. Those dates are also set apart by magic. It was not, and is not, a secret that the 8 dates are days and nights during which the enchanted aura is greatly intensified. No longer is anyone astonished by the magical phenomena and mysterious occurrences that accompany the 8 dates, in particular, the equinoxes and solstices. Everyone is now accustomed to such phenomena, and they seldom evoke a great sensation. But that year it was different. That year people had, as usual, celebrated the autumnal equinox with a solemn family meal, during which all the kinds of fruits from that year's harvest had to be arrayed on the table, even if only a little of each. Custom dictated it. Having eaten and given thanks to the goddess Melitela for the harvest, the people retired for the night, and then the nightmare began. Just before midnight, a frightful storm got up, and a hellish gale blew, in which a ghastly howling, screaming and wailing were heard above the rustling of trees being bent almost to the ground, the creaking of rafters and the banging of shutters. The clouds driven across the sky assumed outlandish shapes, among which the most common were silhouettes of galloping horses and unicorns. The gale did not abate for a good hour, and in the sudden silence that followed it, the night came alive with the trilling and whirring of the wings of hundreds of goat-sucker nightjars, those mysterious fowl which, according to folk tales, gather together to sing a demonic death knell over a dying person. This time, the chorus of nightjars was as mighty and loud as if the entire world were about to expire. The nightjars sang their death knell in clamorous voices, while the horizon became shrouded in clouds, quenching the remains of the moonlight. At that moment sounded the howl of the fell banshee, the harbinger of imminent and violent death, and across the black sky galloped the wild hunt, a procession of fiery-eyed phantoms on skeleton horses, their tattered cloaks and standards fluttering behind them. So it was every few years. The wild hunt gathered its harvest, but it had not been this terrible for decades. In Novigrad alone, over 2 dozen people went missing without a trace. After the hunt had galloped by and the clouds had dispersed, people saw the moon on the wane, as was customary during the equinox. But that night, the moon was the colour of blood. Simple folk had many explanations for these equinoctial phenomena, which tended to differ considerably from each other according to the specifics of local demonology. Astrologers, druids and sorcerers also had their explanations, but they were in the main erroneous and cobbled together haphazardly. Few, very few people were able to connect the phenomena to real facts. On the Isles of Skellige, for example, a few very superstitious people saw in the curious events a harbinger of Teith Dyrea, the end of the world, preceded by Rachnarok, the last battle between light and darkness. The violent storm which rocked the islands on the night of the autumn equinox was regarded by the superstitious as a wave pushed by the prow of the fearsome Naglfar of Morhuch, a longship with sides built of dead men's fingernails and toenails, bearing an army of spectres and demons of chaos. More enlightened or better informed people, however, linked the turmoil of the heavens with the evil witch Yennefer and her dreadful death. Others yet, who were even better informed, saw in the churned-up sea a sign that someone was dying. Someone in whose veins flowed the blood of the kings of Skellige and Sintra. The world over, the autumn equinox was a night of spectres, nightmares and apparitions, a night of sudden, suffocating awakenings, fraught with menace, among sweat-soaked and rumpled sheets. Neither did the most illustrious escape the apparitions and awakenings. Emperor Emrievar Emrys awoke with a cry in the Golden Towers in Nilfgaard. In the north, in Lan Exeter, King Esterad Tyson leapt from his bed, waking his spouse, Queen Zuleika. In Tretogor, the arch-spy Dykstra leapt up and reached for his dagger, waking the wife of the state treasurer. In the huge castle of Monte Calvo, the sorceress Philippa Eilhart leapt from damask sheets without waking the Comte de Denoyle's wife. The dwarf Yarpen Zigrin in Mahakam, the old witcher Vesemir in the mountain stronghold of Kier Morhen, the bank clerk Fabio Sachs in the city of Gors Velen, and Jarl Krachan Krait on board the longboat Ringhorn all awoke more or less abruptly. The sorceress Fringilla Vigo came awake in Beauclerc Castle, as did the priestess Siadrifa of the Temple of the Goddess Freya on the island of Hindirsfal. Daniel Echeverry, Count of Garamond, awoke in the besieged fortress of Maribor, as did Zyvik, Decurion of the Dun Banner in Banjean Fort, and the merchant Dominic Bombastus Uvenagel in the town of Clermont, and many, many others. Few, though, were capable of connecting all those occurrences and phenomena with an actual specific fact, or a specific person. A stroke of luck meant that 3 such people were spending the night of the autumn equinox under one roof. They were in the temple of the goddess Melitela in Elender.
Lichfell,
groaned the scribe Yara, staring into the darkness filling the temple grounds.
There must be thousands of them, whole flocks. They're crying over someone's death. Over her death. She's dying.
Don't talk nonsense. Triss Merigold spun around, raised a clenched fist, and for a moment looked as though she would shove the boy or strike him in the chest.
Do you believe in foolish superstitions? September is coming to an end, and the nightjars are gathering before taking flight. It's quite natural. She's dying. No one is dying,
screamed the sorceress, paling in fury.
No one. Do you understand? Stop talking nonsense.
Several young female adepts appeared in the library corridor, aroused by the nocturnal alarm. Their countenances were grave and ashen.
Yara!
Triss had calmed down. She placed a hand on the boy's shoulder and squeezed hard.
You're the only man in the temple. We're all watching you, looking for support and succor from you. You must not fear. You must not panic. Master yourself. Do not let us down.
Yara took a deep breath, trying to calm the trembling of his hands and lips.
It is not fear,
he whispered, avoiding the sorceress's gaze.
I'm not afraid. I'm troubled. About her. I saw her in a dream. I saw her too.
Triss pursed her lips.
We had the same dream, you, I, and Neneka. Not a word about it. Blood on her face. So much blood. Be silent, I say. Neneka approaches.
The High Priestess joined them. She looked weary. She shook her head in answer to Triss's wordless question. Seeing that Yara had opened his mouth, she forestalled him.
Nothing, sadly. Almost all the girls awoke when the wild hunt flew over the temple, but none of them had a vision. Not even one as hazy as ours. Go to bed, lad. You cannot help.
Back to the dormitory, girls.
She rubbed her face and eyes with both hands.
Oh, the equinox. This accursed night. Go to bed, Triss. We can do nothing.
The sorceress clenched her fists.
This helplessness is driving me to insanity. The thought that somewhere she is suffering, bleeding, that she's in peril. If I only knew what to do, damn it.
Neneka, High Priestess of the Temple of Melitela, turned around.
Have you tried praying?
In the south, far beyond the mountains of Amel, in Ebbing, in the land called Periplut, on the vast marshes crisscrossed by the rivers Velda, Leyte, and Aret, in a place 800 miles as the crow flies from the city of Elender and the Temple of Melitela, a nightmare jerked the old hermit Visigotta from sleep. Once awake, Visigotta could not for the life of him recall his dream, but a weird unease prevented him from falling asleep again.
It's cold, cold, cold,
said Visigotta to himself, as he tramped along a path among the reeds.
It's cold, cold.
Yet another trap was empty. Not a single muskrat. A most unsuccessful night. Visigotta cleaned sludge and duckweed from the trap, muttering curses and sniffing through his frozen nostrils.
It's cold.
He said, walking towards the edge of the swamp.
And September not yet over. It's but 4 days after the equinox. Oh, I don't recall such chills at the end of September. Not for as long as I've lived. And I've lived a long time.
The next and penultimate trap was also empty. Visigotta didn't even feel like cursing.
There's no doubt, he witted on as he walked, that the climate grows colder with every passing year. And now it looks as though the cooling will progress apace. The elves predicted that long since, but who believed in elven forecasts?
Once again, small wings whirred, and incredibly swift grey shapes flashed by above the old man's head. Once again, the fog over the swamps echoed with the wild, intermittent churring of the goatsucker nightjars and the rapid slapping of their wings. Visigotta paid no attention to the birds. He was not superstitious, and there were always plenty of lichfowl on the bogs, particularly at dawn. The air was so thick with them that he feared they would collide with him. No, perhaps there weren't always as many as there were today. Perhaps they didn't always call quite so blood-curdlingly. Ah, well, he thought, latterly nature has been playing queer pranks, and it's been one oddity after another, each one queerer than the last. He was just removing the last empty trap from the water when he heard the neighing of a horse. The nightjars suddenly all fell silent. There were hummocks on the swamps of Periplut, dry, raised places with river birch, alder, dogwood and blackthorn growing on them. Most of the hummocks were surrounded so completely by the bogs that it was impossible for a horse or a rider who didn't know the paths to reach them. But the neighing, Visigotha heard it once again, was coming from one of them hillocks. Curiosity got the better of caution. Visigotha was no expert on horses and their breeds, but he was an aesthete and was able to recognize and appreciate beauty. And the black horse he saw framed against the birch trunks, with its coat gleaming like anthracite, was extraordinarily beautiful. It was the sheer quintessence of beauty. It was so beautiful it seemed unreal. But it was real, and quite really caught in a trap, its reins and bridle entangled in the blood-red, clinging branches of a dogwood bush. When Visigotha went closer, the horse put its ears back and stamped so hard the ground shuddered, jerking its shapely head and whirling around. Now it was clear it was a mare. There was something else, something that made Visigotha's heart pound frantically, and invisible pincers of adrenaline tighten around his throat. Behind the horse, in a shallow hollow, lay a body. Visigotha dropped his sack on the ground and was ashamed of his first thought, which was to turn tail and run. He went closer, exercising caution, because the black mare was stamping her hooves, flattening her ears, baring her teeth on the bit, and just waiting for the opportunity to bite or kick him. The corpse was that of a teenage boy. He was lying face down, with one arm pinned by his trunk, the other extended to one side with its fingers digging into the sand. The boy was wearing a short suede jacket, tight leather breeches, and soft knee-high elven boots with buckles. Visigotha leaned over. And just then, the corpse gave a loud groan. The black mare gave a long, drawn-out neigh and thumped its hooves against the ground. The hermit knelt down and cautiously turned over the injured boy. He involuntarily drew back and hissed at the sight of the ghastly mask of dirt and congealed blood where the boy's face should have been. He delicately picked moss, leaves and sand from the spittle and mucus-covered lips and tried to pull away the matted hair stuck with blood to his cheek. The injured boy moaned softly and tensed up and began to shake. Visigotha peeled the hair away from the boy's face. "A girl," he said aloud, unable to believe what was right in front of him. "It's a girl." That day, had someone quietly crept up at dusk to the remote cottage in the midst of the swamp with its sunken, moss-grown thatched roof, had they peered through the slits of the shutters in the weak glow of tallow candles, they would have seen a teenage girl with her head thickly bound in bandages, lying with almost corpse-like motionlessness on a pallet covered in animal skins. They would also have seen an old man with a grey, wedge-shaped beard and long white hair, which fell down onto his shoulders and back from the edge of a broad bald patch that extended from his soiled forehead far beyond his crown. They would have noticed the old man lighting another tallow candle, placing an hourglass on the table, sharpening a quill, and hunching over a leaf of parchment. Seen him ponder and mumble something to himself, keeping a close watch on the girl lying on the pallet. But it would not have been possible. No one could have seen it. The cottage of the hermit Visigotha was well concealed amidst the marshes, in a wilderness permanently shrouded in mist, where no one dared to venture.
"We shall note down as follows."
Visigotha dipped his quill in the ink.
"Third hour after my intervention. Diagnosis, vulnus incisivum, an open wound dealt with great force using an unidentified sharp instrument, probably a curved blade. It encompasses the left part of the face, beginning in the infraorbital region, running across the cheek and extending as far as the parotid plexus and masseter muscle. The wound is deepest, reaching the periosteum in the initial part beneath the orbit on the zygomatic bone. Probable length of time from when the wound was sustained to when it was first dressed? 10 hours. The quill scratched on the parchment, but the scratching didn't last longer than a few moments, or lines. Visigotta did not find everything he said to himself worthy of being written down. Returning to the dressing of the wound, the old man began again, staring at the flickering and smoking candle flame. Let us write as follows. I did not excise the edges of the cut. I limited myself to the removal of shreds of dead tissue and coagulated blood. I bathed the wound with willow bark extract. I removed dirt and foreign bodies. I put in sutures, hemp sutures. Let it be written that I did not have any other kinds of thread at my disposal. I used a poultice of wolfsbane and applied a formed muslin dressing. A mouse scampered out into the middle of the chamber. Visigotta threw it a piece of bread. The girl on the pallet breathed restlessly and groaned in her sleep.
8th hour following my intervention. Condition of the patient? Unchanged. Condition of the doctor, I mean my condition, has improved since I have enjoyed a little sleep. I can continue my notes.
It behooves me to commit onto these leaves some information about my patient, for posterity. Assuming that posterity reaches these swamps before everything decays and crumbles into dust.
Visigotta sighed heavily, dipped his quill, and wiped it on the edge of his inkwell.
As far as the patient is concerned, he muttered, let the following be noted down. Age, I would say around 16. Tall, strikingly slim build, but by no means puny. No indication of undernourishment. Musculature and physical construction, rather typical for a young elf woman, but no mixed blood traits found. Can't be more than 1/8 elven. A smaller proportion of elven blood may, of course, not leave any traces.
Visigotta only now seemed to have realized that he hadn't written a single word on the page. He put his quill to the parchment, but the ink had dried. The old man was not bothered in the slightest.
May it be noted, he continued, that the girl has had no children. I emphasize, I refer to old scars. No shortage of fresh wounds on her body. The girl has been beaten, flogged, and by various means, probably at her father's hand. She has probably also been kicked. I also found on her body quite a strange distinguishing mark. Let's write this down, for the good of science. The girl has a red rose tattooed on her loins, right by the pubic mound.
Visigotta stared at the sharpened quill point before dipping it into the inkwell. This time, though, he did not forget why he had done it. He quickly began to cover the page with even lines of sloping script. He wrote until the quill was dry.
She was talking and shouting in befuddlement, he said. Her accent and way of expressing herself, if I pass over frequent interjections in profane criminal cant, are quite confusing, difficult to place, but I would risk the assertion that they originate rather from the north than the south. Some of the words...
Once again, his quill scratched over the parchment, much too briefly to write down everything he had said a short while before, and then he took up his monologue in exactly the place he had left it.
Some of the words and names the girl mumbled in her delirium are worth remembering and investigating. Everything suggests a very extraordinary person has found their way to old Visigotta's cottage.
He said nothing for a while and listened.
I just hope, he muttered, that old Visigotta's cottage doesn't prove the end of her road. Visigotta bent over the parchment and even pressed his quill to it, but wrote nothing, not a single letter. He threw the quill onto the table. He breathed heavily for a while, muttered angrily, and blew his nose. He looked at the pallet and listened to the sounds coming from it.
It must be stated and noted, he said in a weary voice, that things look very ill. All my endeavours may be insufficient, and my exertions in vain. My fears were well-founded. The wound is infected. The girl is most worryingly feverish. 3 of the 4 cardinal symptoms of acute inflammation have appeared. Rubor, calor, and tumor can easily be confirmed by eye and touch. When the post-treatment shock passes, the 4th symptom, dolor, will also appear. Let it be writ that almost 1/2 a century has passed since I have practiced medicine. I feel the years weighing on my memory and the dexterity of my fingers. I have little practical skill, and there is little I can do. I have painfully few resources or medicaments. The only hope lies in the young body's immune mechanisms. 12th hour following my intervention. In accordance with expectations came the 4th cardinal symptom of inflammation, dolor. The patient is crying out in pain. The fever and shivers are growing stronger. I have nothing. Not a single physic to give her. I have a small quantity of stinkweed elixir, but the girl is too frail to survive its effects. I also have monkshood, but monkshood would surely kill her. 15th hour following my intervention. Dawn. Patient unconscious. The fever advances rapidly. The shivers intensify. Moreover, powerful spasms of the facial muscles are occurring. If it is tetanus, the girl is done for. Let us hope it is only the facial nerve, or the trigeminal nerve, or both of them. The girl would be left disfigured, but she would live. Visigotta glanced at the parchment, on which not a single word was written. On condition, he said hollowly, that she survives the infection. 20th hour following my intervention. The fever advances. The rubor, calor, tumor, and dolor are reaching, I venture, critical limits. But the girl has no chance of survival, of even reaching those limits. Thus do I write. I, Visigotta of Corvo, do not believe in the existence of gods, but were they by any chance to exist, let them take this girl into their care, and may they forgive me what I have done, if what I did turns out to be in error.
Visigotta put down his quill, rubbed his swollen and itchy eyelids, and pressed a fist against his temple.
I have given her a mixture of stinkweed and monk's hood, he said hollowly. The next hours will determine everything.
He was not sleeping, only dozing, when a knocking and a pounding, accompanied by a groan, wrenched him from his slumber. It was a groan more of fury than of pain. Outside, the day was dawning. A faint light filtered through the slits in the shutters. The hourglass had run its course long before. As usual, Visigotta had forgotten to turn it over. The oil lamp flickered, and the ruby glow of the hearth dimly lit the corner of the chamber. The old man stood up, a
and moved away the makeshift screen of blankets which separated the pallet from the rest of the room, in order to give the patient peace and quiet. The patient had already picked herself up from the floor where she had fallen a moment earlier, and was sitting, hunched on the edge of her pallet, trying to scratch her face under the dressing. Visigota cleared his throat.
I asked you not to rise. You are too feeble. If you need anything, call. I'm always at hand.
Well, I don't want you to be at hand, she said softly, under her breath, but quite clearly. I need to pee.
When he returned to remove the chamber pot, she was lying on her back on the pallet, fingering the dressing attached to her cheek by strips of bandage wrapped around her forehead and neck. When he went over to her again a moment later, she was in the same position.
4 days? She asked, looking at the ceiling.
5. Almost a day has passed since our last conversation. You slept the whole day. That is good. You need sleep.
I feel better.
I'm gladdened to hear it. Let's remove the dressing. I'll help you sit up. Take my hand.
The wound was healing well and cleanly. This time, the removal of the bandages passed without the painful tearing of the dressing from the scab. The girl gingerly touched her cheek. She grimaced, but Visigota knew it wasn't only from the pain. Every time she checked the extent of the disfigurement, she appreciated the gravity of the wound. She made certain, with horror, that what she had touched before had not been a fevered nightmare.
"Do you have a looking-glass?"
"I do not," he lied.
She looked at him, totally clear-headed, possibly for the first time.
"You mean it's that bad?"
she asked, cautiously running her fingers over the stitches.
"It's a very long cut," he mumbled, angry at himself that he was making excuses and justifying himself to a girl. "Your face is still swollen. In a few days I shall remove the sutures. Until then I shall be applying wolfsbane and extract of willow. I shall no longer bandage your entire head. It's healing nicely, very nicely."
She did not reply. She moved her mouth and jaw, and wrinkled and contorted her face, testing what the wound permitted and what not.
"I've made pigeon broth. Will you eat some?"
"I will. But this time, I'll try by myself. It's humiliating to be spoon-fed when I'm not paralyzed."
Eating took her a long time. She lifted the wooden spoon to her mouth cautiously, using as much effort as if it weighed 2 pounds. But she managed without the help of Visigota, who was observing her with interest. Visigota was inquisitive and burning with curiosity. He knew that the girl's return to health would lead to conversations which could throw light on the whole mysterious matter. He knew it and couldn't wait for that moment. He had lived too long alone in the wilderness. She finished eating and sank back onto her pillow. For a moment, she gazed lifelessly at the ceiling, and then turned her head. The extraordinarily large green eyes, Visigota realized once again, gave her face an innocently childlike expression, now clashing violently with her hideously disfigured cheek. Visigota knew those looks. A big-eyed, permanent child, where a physiognomy arousing an instinctive, sympathetic reaction. A perennial girl, even when her 20th, 30th, why, even 40th birthday had long ago sunk into oblivion. Yes, Visigota knew those looks well. His second wife had been like that, and his daughter too.
"I must flee from here," the girl suddenly said. "Urgently. I'm being hunted. You know that, don't you?"
"I do," he nodded. "Those were your first words, which, contrary to appearances, were not ravings. To be more precise, they were among the first. First you asked about your horse and your sword, in that order. Once I had assured you that your horse and sword were in good hands, you became suspicious that I was the comrade of a certain Bonhart, and wasn't treating you but inflicting the torture of hope. When, not without difficulty, I put you right, you introduced yourself as Fulker, and thanked me for saving you."
"I'm glad,"
She turned her head away on the pillow, as though wanting to avoid meeting his eyes.
I'm glad I didn't forget to thank you. I remember that, vaguely. I didn't know what was reality and what was a dream. I was afraid I hadn't thanked you. My name's not Falka.
I learned that, too, although rather accidentally. You were talking in your fever.
I'm a runaway, she said, without turning around. A fugitive? It's dangerous to give me shelter. It's dangerous to know what I'm really called. I must get on my horse and flee before they catch up with me.
A moment ago, he said kindly, you had difficulty sitting on a chamber pot. I don't really see you mounting a horse, but I assure you, you are safe. No one will track you here.
I'm certainly being pursued. They're on my trail, combing the area.
Calm down. It rains every day. No one will find your tracks. You are in a wilderness, in a hermitage, in the home of a hermit who has cut himself off from the world, to such an extent that it would also be difficult for the world to find him. If, however, you wish it, I can look for a way to send tidings about you to your family or friends.
You don't even know who I am.
You are a wounded girl, he interrupted, running from somebody who does not flinch from injuring girls. Do you wish me to pass on some tidings?
There is no one, she replied a moment later,
and Visigotha's ear caught a change in her voice.
My friends are dead. They were massacred.
He made no comment.
I am death,
she began again, in a strange-sounding voice.
Everyone who encounters me dies.
Not everyone, he contradicted, scrutinizing her. Not Bonhart, the one whose name you screamed out in the fever, the one you are running from. Your encounter seems to have harmed you rather than him. Did he cut your face?
No.
She pursed her lips to stifle something which was either a groan or a curse.
My face was cut by Tawny Owl, Stefan Skellen, but Bonhart hurt me much more gravely. More deeply. Did I talk about that in the fever?
Calm down. You're weak. You should avoid powerful emotions.
My name is Ciri.
I'll make you a compress of wolfsbane, Ciri.
Hold on. A moment. Give me a looking glass, I told you. Please!
He did as she asked, judging that he had to, that he could delay it no longer. He even brought the oil lamp, so she could better see what had been done to her face.
Well, yes,
she said in an altered, trembling voice.
Well, yes, it's just as I thought. Almost as I thought.
He went away, pulling the makeshift screen of blankets after him. She tried hard to sob quietly, so he wouldn't hear. The following day, Visigotha removed half of the stitches. Ciri touched her cheek, hissed like a viper, and complained of an intense pain in her ear and heightened sensitivity in her neck near her jaw. Nonetheless, she got up, dressed, and went outside. Visigotha did not protest. He went out with her. He didn't have to help her or hold her up. The girl was healthy and much stronger than he had expected. She only wobbled once outside and held onto the doorframe.
Why,
she said, sucking in lungfuls of air.
What a chill! Is it a frost or what? Winter already? How long have I been lying here? A few weeks?
Exactly 6 days. It's the 5th day of October, but it promises to be a very cold October.
The 5th of October?
She frowned and hissed in pain. How can it be? 2 weeks?
What? What 2 weeks?
Never mind, she shrugged. Perhaps I've got something wrong. But perhaps I haven't. Tell me, what is it that reeks around here?
Pelts. I hunt muskrat, beaver, koipu and otter, and cure their hides. Even hermits have to make a living.
Where's my horse?
In the barn.
The black mare greeted them with a loud neighing, joined by the bleating of Visigoth's goat, which was greatly displeased by having to share its lodgings with another resident. Ciri hugged the horse's neck, patted it and stroked its mane. The mare snorted and pawed the straw with a hoof.
Where's my saddle? Saddlecloth, harness?
Here?
He did not protest, make any comments, nor voice his opinion. He leaned on his stick and said nothing. He did not move when she grunted, trying to lift the saddle. Didn't budge when she staggered beneath the weight and flopped down heavily onto the straw-covered floor with a loud groan. He did not approach her or help her to stand. He watched intently.
Very well,
she said through clenched teeth, pushing away the mare which was trying to shove its nose down her collar.
I get it, but I have to move on from here, damn it. I must.
Where would you go?
He asked coldly. Still sitting on the straw next to her fallen saddle, she touched her face.
As far away as possible.
He nodded, as though her answer had satisfied him, made everything clear, and didn't leave any room for speculation. Ciri struggled to her feet. She didn't even try to reach down to pick up the saddle or harness. She just checked that there was hay and oats in the manger, and began to rub the horse's back and sides with a wisp of straw. Visigotha stood in silence. He didn't have to wait long. The girl staggered against the post supporting the ceiling, now as white as a sheet. Without a word, he handed her his stick.
There's nothing wrong with me. It's just...
It's just you felt giddy, because you're sick and as weak as a kitten. Let's go back. You must lie down.
Ciri went out again at sunset, after sleeping for a good few hours. Visigotha, returning from the river, happened upon her by the bramble hedge.
Don't go too far from the cottage, he said curtly. Firstly, you're too weak.
I'm feeling better.
Secondly, it's dangerous. There is a huge marsh all around us, endless tracts of reeds. You don't know the paths. You might get lost or drown in the bog.
And you?
She said, pointing at the sack he was dragging.
Know the paths, of course, and you don't walk that far, so the swamp can't be so huge at all. You tan hides to support yourself, I understand. Kelpie, my mare, has oats, but I don't see any fields around here. We ate chicken and groats, and bread. Real bread, not flat bread. You couldn't have got the bread from a trapper. So there's a village nearby.
Unerringly deduced, he calmly agreed. Indeed, I get provisions from the nearest village. The nearest, which doesn't mean it's near. It lies on the edge of the swamp. The swamp adjoins the river. I exchange pelts for food, which they bring me by boat. Bread, kasha, flour, salt, cheese. Sometimes a coney or a hen. Occasionally news.
No question was forthcoming, so he continued.
A band of horsemen on the hunt were in the village twice. The first time they warned people not to hide you. They threatened the peasants with fire and sword if you were seized in the village. The second time they promised a reward for finding your corpse. Your pursuers are convinced that you're lying dead in the forests, in a gorge or a ravine.
They won't rest, she muttered, until they find a body. They have to have proof that I'm dead. They won't give up without that proof. They'll root around everywhere until they finally end up here.
It really matters to them, he observed. I'd say it matters uncommonly to them.
She pursed her lips.
Don't be afraid. I'll leave before they find me here. I won't put you at risk. Don't be afraid.
Why do you think I'm afraid?
He shrugged.
Is there a reason to be afraid? No one will find this place. No one will track you here. If, however, you stick your nose out of the reeds, you'll fall straight into your pursuer's hands.
In other words, she tossed her head proudly, I have to stay here. Is that what you mean?
You aren't a prisoner. You can leave when you want, more precisely whenever you're able to. But you can stay with me and wait. Your pursuers will eventually become disheartened. They always get disheartened, sooner or later. Always. You can believe me. I know what I'm saying.
Her green eyes flashed when she looked at him.
And anyway, he said quickly, shrugging and avoiding her gaze, you'll do as you please. I repeat, I'm not holding you a prisoner here.
I don't think I'll leave today, she said. I'm too weak, and the sun will soon be setting. And anyway, I don't know the paths. So let's go back to the cottage. I'm frozen.
You said I was lying here for 6 days. Is that true?
Why would I lie?
Well, don't take on. I'm trying to count the days. I ran away. I was wounded on the day of the equinox, the 23rd of September, if you prefer to count according to the elves, the last day of Lunasar.
That's impossible. Why would I lie?
She screamed, and then groaned, grabbing her face. Visigotta looked calmly at her.
I don't know why, he said coldly, but I was once a doctor, Ciri. Long ago, and I'm still capable of distinguishing between a wound inflicted 10 hours ago and one inflicted 4 days ago. I found you on the 27th of September, so you were wounded on the 26th, the third day of Valen, if you prefer to count according to the elves, 3 days after the equinox.
I was wounded on the equinox itself.
That's impossible, Ciri. You must have got the dates wrong.
I most certainly haven't. You've got some antiquated hermit calendar here.
Have it your way. Does the date carry such importance?
No, it doesn't.
Visigotta removed the last stitches 3 days later. He had every reason to be pleased and proud of his work. The line was even and clean. There was no need to fear a tattoo of dirt embedded in the wound. However, the satisfaction of the surgeon was spoiled by the sight of Ciri, in somber silence, contemplating the scar in the looking-glass held at various angles and trying vainly to cover it by pulling her hair over her cheek. The scar disfigured her. It was simply a fact. Nothing could be done. Pretending that it was different could not help in any way. Still scarlet, bulging like a cord, surrounded by needle punctures and marked with the scars from the stitches, the scar looked truly horrifying. There was a chance of it undergoing gradual or even rapid improvement. Visigotta knew, though, that there was no chance of the disfiguring scar vanishing. Ciri was feeling much better, and to Visigotta's astonishment and pleasure, did not talk about leaving at all. She led her black mare, Kelpie, out of the barn. Visigotta knew that in the north, the name Kelpie was borne by a water spirit, a dangerous sea monster, according to superstition, able to assume the form of a splendid steed, dolphin, or even a comely woman, although in reality it always looked like a heap of seaweed. Ciri saddled her mare and trotted around the yard and cottage, after which Kelpie went back to the barn to keep the goat company, while Ciri went to the cottage to keep Visigotta company. She even helped him, probably out of boredom, as he worked with the pelts. While he was segregating the koipu according to their size and colouring, she divided the muskrats up into backs and bellies, slitting the skins along slats inserted into them. Her fingers were exceptionally nimble. While they worked, they had quite a strange conversation.
You don't know who I am. You can't even imagine who I am.
She repeated that banal statement several times and slightly annoyed him with it. Of course, he did not betray his annoyance. He wouldn't betray his feelings before such a chit. No, he couldn't allow that, nor could he betray the curiosity that was consuming him.
groundless curiosity in truth, for he could have guessed who she was without any difficulty. Gangs of youths hadn't been rare in Visigoth's younger days either, nor could the years that had passed eliminate the magnetic power with which gangs lured whelps hungry for adventure and thrills, very often to their death. Whelps flaunting scars on their faces could count their luck. Torture, the noose, the hook or the stake awaited the less fortunate of them. Since Visigoth's younger days, only one thing had changed: growing emancipation. Not only teenage boys, but also reckless girls, preferring a horse, a sword and adventures to lace-making, the spinning wheel and waiting for the matchmakers. Visigoth did not say all that straight out. He said it in a roundabout way, but so that she knew that he knew. To make her aware that if someone in the cottage was an enigma, it was certainly not her, a young thug from a band of underage thugs who had miraculously escaped a manhunt, a disfigured teenage girl trying to cloak herself in an aura of mystery.
"You don't know who I am. But don't worry. I'll be leaving shortly. I won't put you at risk."
Visigoth had had enough. "I'm not at risk," he said dryly. "For what peril would there be? Even if a search party were to show up here, which I doubt, what ill could befall me? Giving help to fugitive criminals is punishable, but not for a hermit, since a hermit is unaware of worldly matters. It is my privilege to give asylum to anyone who comes to my retreat. You said it correctly. I don't know who you are. How am I, a hermit, to know who you are, what mischief you've been up to, and why the law is pursuing you, and which law? For I don't even know what law applies in this region, or what and whose jurisdiction I live in. And it does not concern me. I am a hermit." He had mentioned the hermit's life a few too many times. He sensed it, but he did not quit. Her furious green eyes pricked him like spurs. "I am a penniless anchorite, dead to the world and its concerns. I'm a simple, uneducated man, unaware of worldly matters." That was an exaggeration. "Like hell you are," she yelled, hurling a pelt and the knife to the floor. "Do you take me for a fool? I'm not a fool. Be sure of that. A hermit. A penniless anchorite. I had a look around when you weren't here. I looked in the corner, behind that rather filthy curtain. How did learned books get on those shelves, eh? My simple, ignorant man."
Visigoth threw a koipu skin down on the pile.
"A tax collector once lived here," he said lightheartedly. "They are cadasters and bookkeeping ledgers."
"You're lying."
Ciri grimaced, massaging her scar.
"You're lying through your teeth."
He did not reply, pretending to be assessing the hue of another hide.
"Perhaps you think," the girl began again, "that if you have a white beard, wrinkles, and you've lived 100 years, you can easily hoodwink a naive young maid, eh? Let me tell you, maybe you would have tricked just any lass, but I'm not just any lass."
He raised his eyebrows in a wordless but provocative question. He didn't have to wait long.
"I, my dear hermit, have studied in places where there were plenty of books, including the same titles you have on your shelves. I know plenty of them."
Visigoth raised his eyebrows even higher. She looked him straight in the eye.
"This filthy sloven, this ragged orphan," she drawled, "is saying strange things. Must be a thief or bandit discovered in the bushes with her mush cut up. And yet you ought to know, hermit, that I have read the history of Roderick de November. I've looked through the Materia Medica several times. I know the Herbarius you have on your shelf. I also know what the Gules cross ermine blazon on the spines of those books means. It means the book was published by the University of Oxenfurt."
She broke off, still observing him intently. Visigoth was silent, trying not to let his face betray anything.
"Which is why I think," she said, making her habitual sharp, haughty toss of head, "that you aren't a simple hermit at all, that you didn't die for the world either, but fled from it. And you're hiding here in the wilderness, disguised by appearances and a boundless reed bed."
"If that is so," Visigoth smiled, "then our fates really have become uncannily entwined, my well-read young lady."
This destiny has flung us together in a highly mysterious way. After all, you're also in hiding. You too, Ciri, are skillfully spinning a veil of deception around yourself. I am, however, an old man, full of suspicion and embittered, senile mistrust.
Mistrust regarding me?
Regarding the world, Ciri. A world in which a deceptive appearance dons the mask of truth to pull the wool over the eyes of another truth, a false one, incidentally, which also tries to deceive. A world in which the arms of the University of Oxenfurt are painted on the doors of bordellos. A world in which wounded thugs pass themselves off as worldly learned and perhaps nobly born maidens, intellectuals and polymaths, reading Roderick de Novembre and familiar with the crest of the Academy, in spite of all appearances, in spite of the fact they carry another mark, a bandit's tattoo, a red rose tattooed on the groin.
Indeed, you were right.
She bit her lip, and her face turned a crimson so intense that the line of the scar seemed black.
You are an embittered old man, and a nosy old prick.
On my shelf behind the curtain,
he nodded toward it,
is a copy of Enog Mab Teirth Moch, a collection of elven fairy tales and rhyming parables. There is a story there of a venerable old raven and a youthful swallow, very fitting to our situation and conversation. Because I am a polymath like you, Ciri, let me quote an appropriate excerpt. The raven, as you certainly recall, accuses the swallow of flightiness and unseemly frivolity.
In herbin dich e noch zireel, ach ach, kem voelte veloel, zireel.
He broke off, rested his elbows on the table and his chin on his interlocked fingers. Ciri jerked her head, straightened up, and looked at him defiantly, and completed the verse.
Zireel veloe, que es eesanach, mabo hen herbin vian ich quirch quirch.
The embittered and mistrustful old man,
Visagotta said a moment later, without changing his position,
apologizes to the young polymath. The venerable old raven, sensing everywhere deceit and trickery, asks for forgiveness of the swallow, whose only crime is to be young and full of life. And very pretty.
Now you're talking drivel,
she said crossly, involuntarily covering the scar on her cheek.
You can forget compliments like that. They won't correct those wonky stitches you tacked my skin with. Don't think either that you'll gain my trust by apologizing. I still don't know who you really are, why you lied to me about those dates and days, or why you looked between my legs when I'd been wounded in the face, and if looking was where it finished.
This time she made him lose his temper.
What are you saying, you brat? He roared. I could be your father.
Grandfather, she corrected him coldly, or even great-grandfather. But you aren't. I don't know who you are. But you are certainly not who you pretend to be.
I am he who found you on the bog, almost frozen to the moss, with a black crust instead of a face, unconscious and filthy. I am he who took you home, although I didn't know who you were, and was within my rights to expect the worst. Who bandaged you and put you to bed, tended to you when you were expiring with fever, nursed you, washed you, thoroughly, in the tattoo region as well.
She blushed again, but had no intention of changing her insolent, defiant expression.
In this world, she growled, deceptive appearances occasionally feign the truth. You said it yourself. I also know the world a little, if you can imagine it. You rescued me, tended my wounds, nursed me. Thank you for that. I'm grateful for your kindness. Although I know that there is no such thing as kindness without
a calculation or the hope of some profit.
He finished with a smile.
Yes, yes, I know. I'm a worldly man. Perhaps I know the world as well as you do, Ciri. Wounded girls, of course, are robbed of everything that has any value.
If they're unconscious or too weak to defend themselves, free rein is normally given to one's urges and lust, often in immoral and unnatural ways. Isn't that so?
Nothing is as it seems,
answered Ciri, her cheeks reddening once more.
How true a statement,
he said, throwing another pelt on one of the piles.
And how mercilessly does it lead us to the conclusion that we, Ciri, know nothing about each other. We know only appearances, and appearances are deceptive.
He waited a while, but Ciri wasn't hurrying to say anything.
Although both of us have managed to carry out something of a provisional inquisition, we still know nothing about each other. I don't know who you are. You don't know who I am.
This time, he waited with calculation. She looked at him, and in her eyes there was the hint of the question he was expecting. Something strange flashed in her eyes when she posed the question.
Who shall begin?
Had someone crept up after nightfall to the cottage with the sunken, moss-grown thatched roof, had peered inside, in the firelight and glow of the hearth, they would have seen a grey-bearded old man hunched over a pile of pelts. They would have seen an ashen-haired girl with a hideous scar on her cheek, a scar which in no way suited her huge, green, childlike eyes. But no one could have seen that, for the cottage stood among reeds in a swamp where no one dared to venture.
My name is Visogotta of Corvo. I was once a doctor. A surgeon. I was an alchemist. I was a scholar, a historian, a philosopher, and an ethicist. I was a professor at the Academy of Oxenfurt. I had to flee after publishing a paper which was deemed godless. At that time, 50 years ago, it was punishable by death. I had to emigrate. My wife did not want to emigrate, so she left me. And I only ceased my flight when I reached the far south, in the Nilfgaardian Empire. Later, I finally became a lecturer in ethics at the Imperial Academy in Castelgrappien, a position I held for almost 10 years. But I had to run from there, too, after the publication of another treatise. Incidentally, the work dealt with totalitarian power and the criminal character of imperialist wars, but officially, I and my work were accused of metaphysical mysticism and clerical schism. It was ruled I had been goaded into action by the expansive and revisionist groups of priests who were actually governing the kingdoms of the Nordlings. Quite amusing in the light of my death sentence for atheism 20 years previously. Indeed, it so happened that the expansive priests in the north had long since been forgotten by their people, but that had not been acknowledged in Nilfgaard. Combining mysticism and superstition with politics was a severely punishable offence. Today, looking back down the years, I think that, had I humbled myself and shown remorse, perhaps the scandal would have blown over, and the Emperor limited himself to disfavour without using extreme measures. But I was bitter. I considered some of my arguments timeless, superior to this or that dominion or politics. I felt wronged, unjustly wronged, tyrannously wronged. So I made active contact with the dissidents secretly fighting the tyrant. Before I knew it, I was in a dungeon with those dissidents, and some of them, when they were shown the torture instruments, pointed me out as the movement's chief ideologue. The Emperor availed himself of his privilege to issue a pardon, though I was sentenced to exile, under the threat of immediate execution should I return to Imperial territories. Thus, I took offence against the entire world, against kingdoms, empires, and universities, against dissidents, civil servants, and lawyers, against my colleagues and friends who stopped being such at the touch of a magic wand, against my second wife who, like my first, thought her husband's difficulties a suitable reason for a divorce, against my children, who disowned me. I became a hermit, here in Ebbing, in the Periplut Marshes. I inherited a dwelling from an anchorite I had once known. Unfortunately, Nilfgaard annexed Ebbing, and all of a sudden I found myself in the Empire again. Now I have neither the strength nor the inclination to continue wandering, so I must hide. Imperial sentences do not lapse, even in a situation when the Emperor who issued it died long ago, and the present Emperor has no cause to remember the previous one fondly or share his views. The death sentence remains in force. That is the law and custom in Nilfgaard. Sentences for high treason do not expire, and neither are they subject to the amnesties that every emperor proclaims after his coronation. After the accession to the throne of a new emperor, everybody who was sentenced by his predecessor is given an amnesty, except those guilty of high treason. It is unimportant who reigns in Nilfgaard. If news gets out that I'm alive and am